This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, is off doing the people's business. Coming up, the Trayvon Martin killing mobilizes blacks like nothing since Katrina, and the nation's premier anti-war group says no to U.S. intervention in Syria and Iran. But first, the Green Party Black Caucus has endorsed entertainment personality Roseanne Barr as the party's presidential candidate. The decision came at the urging of 2008 Green Party presidential standard bearer Cynthia McKinney, the former congresswoman from Georgia. We asked Green Party Black Caucus spokesman Thomas Muhammad if Roseanne Barr's high name recognition had a lot to do with the choice.
Exactly, and that's because the reality is to break through that media, particularly so-called mainstream media, which I call the white media, to break through that, a person has to have that type of recognition to do it. That's unfortunate because when it comes to media, it's either negative publicity or name ID, period, that gets you on the front page or in papers spread across the country and, of course, on television news and the talk shows and all of that kind of stuff, including the sitcoms like Saturday Night Live or whatever else. Well, Roseanne will be able to bust through that because of her name ID. That's important because the more attention she gets, the more attention the party gets. And the more attention the party gets, the more attention the party candidates will get. And so she has a way of shining light on everyone based on the light that's reflected on her. And so that's the reality of politics. And if you can't, if you don't have it automatically, you got to spend a ton of money to get it done, particularly on the national level, where media buys are so expensive. So, yeah, Roseanne brings that type of advantage in. So, yes, we're talking about name ID will get us out there.
And politically, it seems that the endorsement by Cynthia McKinney was absolutely critical.
It was very critical because without that, some of our party members were looking elsewhere or just basically talking about, you know, look, we have nothing in this race, really. That's internally what we were dealing with. The other candidates, we didn't believe would deal with the types of issues that a Roseanne Barr would deal with, similar to what Cynthia McKinney would deal with, and that is speaking truth to power, telling the truth no matter where you are, regardless of who it hurts, no favoritism anywhere, and the issues. I mean, the issues of stopping these wars, stopping the corporate buys of elections, trying to find a way to clean up society in terms of creating good, clean, healthy, green jobs, and finding ways to stop the violence and the senseless killings and redeveloping in communities, inner city communities in particular, throughout this country. And so those are the type of issues that Roseanne Barr will tackle. And that's what she said to us and indicated to us in our conversation with her. And those are the issues that our sister Cynthia McKinney also supported. And so, yes, the endorsement from Cynthia McKinney sent from Roseanne Barr to the high levels as far as the caucus is concerned.
Thomas Muhammad in Houston, speaking for the Black Caucus of the Green Party. Hundreds of activists gathered in Stamford, Connecticut for the National Conference of UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition. The theme was opposition to U.S. wars at home and abroad. The conference put UNAC on record as saying no to any U.S. and NATO military intervention against Syria or Iran, and no to economic embargoes, sanctions, or threats against those countries. Sarah Flanders of the International Action Center expressed the sentiments of the conference.
In fighting today's wars, its most important step is building a movement that acknowledges the connection between the war at home and the war abroad. It's a big challenge. How dare any U.S. official in any lecture any other country on prisoners, on human rights, or on democracy? What hypocrisy! This country has the largest prison population in the world, and that's not counting the secret prisons, the secret renditions, the kidnappings, the drones. It's not counting immigration detention. We need to consciously step back from ever being an echo of the State Department and their arrogant charges that target other countries. U.S. wars, they rely on an arrogance of empire. Can they once again get the population to believe that a humanitarian war is possible, that they're bringing democracy, advancement for women, an end to sectarian violence? We need an anti-war movement that is really consciously against all U.S. wars. That's simple. And against all the forms that U.S. wars take today. Bombs and occupations, yes, but sanctions, sabotage, drones, media onslaughts, demonization of leaders, racist stereotypings of whole peoples. We represent here many different political currents and traditions here in this room, and we can't and won't agree on many issues. So how do we proceed? How do we stay united and keep our focus? If we focus on U.S. imperialism, on its crimes, whatever our views on many social issues, we will be together because we need an anti-war movement that opposes U.S. war. Consider the U.S.-NATO war against Libya. 11 countries simultaneously dropping bombs on a country with no means of defense, all claiming they're on a humanitarian mission while they target the electric grid, the water supply, civilian communications. Now let's talk about WikiLeaks' latest Stratford revelation. And by the way, free Bradley Manning. The latest WikiLeaks document in the Stratford files, they describe in some detail the White House meeting that reviews British and French and U.S. special forces units on the ground in Syria, planting bombs, running guns, training, and seeking total destabilization. Now, that's the truth. UNAC today, and this is so important, stands for self-determination and demands that all U.S. troops, drones, and sabotage teams out. Unconditional U.S. withdrawal. That's a big contribution, a big step. We can't be making demands on any country at the very time it's under attack, at the time the bombs are falling, at the time the sanctions are strangling. Today, in the last weeks, we see the most cynical and arrogant approach. Kony 2012, right? Invisible Children. And what is it, young people cheering AFRICOM, U.S. troops in Africa? That's the way they sell U.S. wars today. There's a rapidly expanding U.S. military presence in Africa. It includes troops in Uganda, a military mission in Mali, drone bombings in Somalia, political intervention in Sudan, all under the umbrella of AFRICOM. It's blame the victim. It saturates the media and it saturates the mass movement. We need to stand up to it. And just on a personal level, and to give a comparison, there was a time when if a woman was attacked, sexually assaulted, what was the defense of the attacker, of the courts and of the police? It was to ask, what was she wearing, doing, where was she walking, that she invited or deserved this attack? And one gain of the women's movement was to say, it's irrelevant. That is irrelevant. That's a way... We have to see U.S. wars. That is the way. Let's talk about Syria and Libya and Iraq and Iran and Venezuela and Bolivia and Sudan. U.S. imperialism wants to destroy each of these countries, not because they've made any compromises to survive, and they have, but because they've nationalized the source of wealth, because it's U.S. domination, corporate domination, that they want. This empire has problems they can no longer solve. Capitalism can no longer bail itself out with war. The capitalist crisis is global. It's unsolvable. So our unity is more important. The United National Anti-War Coalition, UNAC, was founded on the principle of self-determination for all the oppressed nations and people. What do we want to demand in Chicago? Abolish NATO. Abolish NATO. Really, that's the way to put it. We want to talk about march on the RNC and the DNC. Abolish NATO and end the wars at home and abroad.
That was Sarah Flanders at the United National Anti-War Coalition Conference in Stamford, Connecticut. Black Agenda Report was strongly represented at the conference. Nellie Bailey, Bruce Dixon, and yours truly spoke at the gathering, as did Bar editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly.
It's a great pleasure to be here today, speaking to a group of people who proudly proclaim themselves to be anti-war. Now, I was told I only have 3 minutes to speak, which is both a hard and easy task at the same time. So I'll get to my main point, which is pretty simple. You cannot be anti-war and pro-Obama. We can't discuss this issue of NATO and the G8 gatherings without talking about Barack Obama. The two events were originally planned to take place in Chicago, which is no coincidence. It's the president's home and his political base. His former chief of staff now serves as the mayor there. And these events were intended to be coronations for the Obama doctrine, which states that the United States can kill and steal whenever it wants to and wherever it wants to, and does so in a fashion which keeps liberals happy, even as acts which they decried under Bush are carried out by Obama. Those of us who are anti-war are not fooled because a Democrat makes war instead of a Republican, or because the current war-making Democrat is a black man. As we all know, the G8 meeting was moved from Chicago to Camp David because the president and his G8 friends are afraid of protest. They are afraid of us. The change of venue for the G8 summit is a sign of success, but we can't rest on our laurels and forget the awful forces represented by NATO and the G8. These forces will not be happy until the people of the world accept their rule without question or protest. We know that the goal of the G8 is to turn the whole world into Greece, a country which, among other things, now has no minimum wage, no regulation of corporate activities, and a shrunken welfare state safety net. NATO is an organization which should have outlived its usefulness. It was always a counterweight to the Warsaw Pact nations, but the Soviet Union no longer exists, and former Warsaw Pact and Soviet republics like Poland, Bulgaria, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Romania, Latvia, and Estonia are now all NATO members. Actually, I should correct myself there. There is a reason for NATO to exist, and that is to further the interests of empire and Western capital. NATO is a tool of imperialism, and we saw that all very clearly in Libya. The United States, France, and the UK conspired to bring down a sovereign nation's government, kill its leader, spread a race war and lynch law, and divide Libya into weak fiefdoms incapable of stopping their collaborators from turning over their resources to NATO and G8 countries. The bombings of civilians and the lies told to the world about a phony humanitarian agenda were all carried out in NATO's name. Now, I know that anti-NATO and G8 protests are being planned this weekend, and I also know that the Nobel Peace Prize-winning president recently signed legislation which makes it a felony to protest at national security events where Secret Service are present, and that makes these actions very dangerous. But speaking of protest, just as an aside, the actions at the political conventions this summer should be restricted to the Democrats. They are, after all, the party in power, and they're the only ones who we need to protest to. But even so, resistance is still the order of the day. I thank you very much.
Our next speaker is Glenn Ford. He is the executive director of the Black Agenda Report and is co-host of the Black Agenda Radio.
Good afternoon and power to the people. Now, I found that in talks like this, at least I do better if I just focus on one point. So I want to discuss the past 40 years of mass black incarceration as the national policy of the United States. And when I say national policy, I mean mass black incarceration is the policy of every jurisdiction of our country, east and west and north and south and big city and rural. That is the national policy. We at Black Agenda Report have maintained that mass black incarceration is the greatest challenge and affront to Black America because it mangles Black internal social relations and impacts every aspect of Black life. It settles like a cloud on everything that occurs in Black America. I'm sure that others will go into detail, as the good doctor did, on the stats surrounding mass Black incarceration. But for me, the most horrific number is that one out of every eight prison inmates on the planet is an African American. One out of eight. And yet African Americans make up only about half of 1% of planet Earth's population. That statistic alone serves to illuminate who and what the United States is among the world community of nations. It illuminates its essential character as a society that is not just steeped in racism, but is largely organized around race and around racial oppression. That's what the vast African-American gulag really means. That's what that number tells us. And although the left now puts mass Black incarceration high up on the list of social ills, I think that this great scourge is still sort of compartmentalized rather than seen as central to how U.S. society has been structured over the last 40 years. Sarah Flanders put it perfectly this morning when she said that the Trayvon Martin murder flows from the racism that is at the very root of U.S. society. And yet, I don't think that most of us see mass Black incarceration as the great malignancy that grows from the root racism of this society. Certainly, we don't see that kind of recognition among the Black misleadership class, most of which seems to be more ashamed than outraged at mass Black incarceration. And even on the left, we find that mass Black incarceration is explained as an outgrowth of the national security industrial complex, or that it's a product of a strategy to control surplus workers. These are aspects of mass Black incarceration in the United States. But that is not the central dynamic. The central dynamic is white supremacy. The most difficult fact to face for many progressives and for the Black misleadership class is that mass Black incarceration, as we have known it for the past four decades, is a general white response to the Black freedom movement of the 60s. And even more broadly, it is a general white response to Black assertions of full humanity in what most white people consider to be their national space. Now, the important words here are general white response. And by that I mean that masses of white people, large majorities in every part of the country, whether those regions were heavily populated by Black people or not, very quickly joined in damn near universal project to put Black people under hyper-surveillance and behind bars, beginning in earnest in the late 60s and the early 70s. What was more striking than the eightfold increase in the overall incarcerated population since 1970 and the astronomical proportion of prisoners that were Black, what is even more striking than that is the near uniformity of the spread of mass Black incarceration across the country. It was not a Southern phenomenon. It wasn't a big city phenomenon, but a general national phenomenon that swept every region and every state and very, very quickly. The black American gulag stretches from sea to sea, and it got that way in the space of a very few short years. This is a prison regime that was put together, or at least vastly strengthened, with amazing speed and fantastic uniformity by local and by state governments and local and state police forces, consistent, and this is the important part, consistent with the demands of majorities of the white citizenry. It is absolutely true that a national political guiding hand was at work in instituting mass black incarceration as we know it. It was at work in orchestrating an hysteria around the so-called war on drugs. That's not debatable. And it's also true that the evolving national security state used that hysteria to tighten its social controls over American society as a whole, not just over black people. But white America was already hysterical about black people's perceived intrusions and violations of white social space. And that was before there was any declaration of a war on drugs by the federal government. If there was any phenomenon that was more swift, more striking, and more disruptive of American patterns of life than black mass incarceration has been, it was white flight from the cities. Much of urban America was deflated like a balloon in the early to late 60s, leaving behind a black core. White people back then, just as now, claimed that they were retreating in the face of crime, even though crime rates were far lower. And even though back in those days, in the mid-60s, 70% of the nation's prison inmates were white. It's roughly reverse that today. I believe that white America was primed for a massive lockdown of black people, and that was before Nixon's first war on drugs, before he initiated his Southern strategy, and before Nixon was even elected. All it took was an articulation of the code words, and the response was reflexive and breathtakingly fast, so that by 1970, we see the prison numbers begin to explode. We at Black Agenda Report like to say that mass black incarceration was white people's way of saying, okay, you black people refuse to stay in your place, so we've got a place for you, and that place is behind bars, or it's on in the ground. So, yes, the prison industrial complex has now been interwoven with the national economy, and it is vital to thousands of cities and towns, and it is a mainstay for millions of employees, but that's not the root of the dynamic. And it is true that the armies of black unemployed are largely controlled by the U.S. criminal justice system. And when they enter the prisons, they are no longer classified as unemployed. But prison populations keep growing no matter what the unemployment rate over these past 40 years. Up or down, the prison population is always up. It's declined slightly at state institutions very lately, but that's because the states have run out of money. But the federal prison system continues to grow because it is responding to that dynamic. The dynamic of mass black incarceration is disconnected from unemployment figures. It is disconnected from crime rates. That's because the primary dynamic is white racism. The white electorate in every region demanded mass black incarceration. This is, therefore, a mass white phenomenon, and a terrifyingly uniform one. It is considered, that is, mass incarceration is considered an intractable problem, but what is really intractable is white racism. Mass black incarceration may serve the 1%, but it was a punishment demanded by majorities of the white section of the 99%. Punishments against black people for the crime of asserting themselves as human beings. And this cannot be papered over by any organizations that seek human liberation. Power to the people.
Our next speaker is Nellie Bailey. She co-founded the Harlem Tenants Council in 1994 and is a leader of Occupy Harlem. She produces Inside Housing, WHCR 90.3 FM radio, and co-hosts Black Agenda Report Radio. Thank you, everyone. Are we ready for revolution? Are we ready for Obama? Good. Good way to start the conversation. I want to talk a little bit in a broader context of the internal colonies of Black America that is facing a brutal structural adjustment of the kind even more brutal than that carried out in the developing countries. Although now we know that these greedy imperialists are taking down Europe. Not even white Europe was safe enough then to become their new targets of pillage and supporting and propping up banks, not only here in this country, but throughout the globe. These are the kinds of gangsters that we are dealing with. U.S. imperialism. And if we don't come together, then we will perish. If we don't come together as Black, white, Latino, Asian, immigrant communities, we will perish. And that is what they want. In 2007, when the U.S. imperialists introduced Barack Obama to us, I, along with a number of other activists, we said, uh-oh, what's this? And to our chagrin, those of our comrades and activists, some who had even labeled themselves Marxists and progressives, fell in line. That blind spot of this is our man, when in fact he a servant of the 1%. The obscenity of Obama's actions in Harlem speaks volume of his heartless disdain for Black America, who supports him regardless of what he does, and will attack anyone who attempts to hold him accountable. Two quick examples. Obama came to Harlem in October of last year. Incredibly, he came to a community that has an annual median income of $25,000. But do you know why he was there? He was there at a $30,000 plate dinner. I have to pause here to say there was opposition because the Harlem Tenant Council, which I am director of, including others, were there with a protest. We called it a Hold Obama Accountable protest. We had about 200 people at that protest. If that wasn't enough, and quote, in an attempt to clean up that disdain and insult to Harlem, he came back this year, days after he had passed the National Defense Authorization Act. But you know what? We were out on the street that night across from the Apollo Theater,
and we let him know what we thought of him. He will not roll us over with this disdain and disrespect. We will hold him accountable again and again and again. And we have done this against great odds from the diehard Obamaites, those who ironically support Obama. And if you support Obama, you are supporting U.S. imperialism and what they do in this surreptitious kind of way, supporting Obama but hating Whitey. If that's not an oxymoron, I don't know what is. Now, just let me finally talk about our collaboration and why that is important in terms of our base and expanding our base and going out of Harlem. We have worked with the Chinese staff workers and MMAS, the National Mobilization Against Sweatshops, for nearly 10 years. And I remember we had a demonstration in Harlem, an anti-gentrification demonstration, where we marched down 125th, Harlem's main commercial artery, and our friends were there with us, and it was a beautiful sight. Blacks, Latinos, and Asian marching down 125th Street. People almost got whiplash because it was so significant. This is the kind of work that we do. At some point, if anyone wants to know about that gangster, Columbia University, a proxy for Obama, please come and talk to me, because they want to build an underground research laboratory experimenting with level 3 pathogens, SARS and Ebola, in a flood plain area. That's how greedy these corporations are. Columbia University is not an education institution. It's the third largest landlord in New York City. That is their bread and butter. That's how they make their money. And they don't give a damn about their students. And they give even less of a damn about Harlem, the community of Harlem, that historic community. Thank you so much.
Our next speaker is Bruce Dixon. He was a member of the Black Panther Party and is now managing editor at Black Agenda Report.
In Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, she throws out a fact that illustrates how deeply entrenched the prison state is when she says that to roll back the levels of incarceration in the United States to their 1980 levels, we'd not only have to let out about 1.5 million people out of prison, but we'd have to put more than 1 million Americans out of work. We're talking about cops, sheriffs, bailiffs, judges, contractors for prisons, and state's attorneys, and the people who push paper in the courts and push paper in the prisons. The prison state, as a previous speaker has pointed out to us, is definitely very much a bipartisan thing. It's not a Republican thing, and it's not a Democratic thing. So what I'm going to talk about here are two things, that some of the challenges that we're having in Georgia in building a movement against the prison state. Broadly speaking, there are two kinds of challenges. Number one is you have to make a political space for yourself where none exists right now. And the second challenge, which I won't be able to spend as much time on because I don't have as many answers on it, is how to build and sustain an organization also where none exists now in that political space. Just like the historic cases of the labor movement, environmentalism, anti-war settlement, and much else, the wave of conscious actions ostensibly aimed at the prison state, the prison industrial and school-to-prison contraptions and on such presents a lot of opportunities for hijacking, for co-optation, and for containing said movement within the universe bound by the horizons of the two corporate political parties. Their horizons are basically what can be pushed through a state legislature this session or the next session, or what liberal and corporate philanthropy will fund. and the universe of what contracts, what private-public partnerships, and what patronage can be extracted or wrung from government by those claiming to be representatives or advocates of the oppressed and downtrodden. You know, we've got a black political class who that's basically now their MO, managers of the problem. And they're the subcontractors. And, you know, that's what they are. Anybody close to any kind of leftish activism over the years cannot have helped but notice how whatever folks are doing, whether it's around housing or immigration or LGBT stuff or women's rights or labor, anti-war, you name it, how all of it tends to shut down about a quarter past every even-numbered year. What's up with that, huh? You know, so that we can focus on what people tell us is really important, right? What's really important is electing Democrats. Isn't that what they tell us? That's what's really important, not this housing stuff you're doing, not this LGBT stuff, not this prison stuff you're doing. But in reality, what that is, that's a dance. It's a dance where every step in the process is delimited and mapped out ahead of time by laws, by corporate media, and by custom. And confining and containing the movement against mass incarceration within those boundaries, making them stick to that dance, is absolutely vital to the establishment's legitimacy and, in the black community, to the legitimacy of the black political class. So, here's what they're doing in Georgia. Everybody here knows what the United Way is. The United Way is the philanthropic arm of corporate America. We're talking about Bank of America, public supermarkets, IBM, GE, GM, and on such. Did you know that the United Way funds community organizers in 165 cities around the country? How many people already knew that? Now, how many of you know where those community organizers come from? Who trains them? Nope. Any other guesses? How about the AFL-CIO? Okay? I ain't making this up. It's on United Way's website. Go look for it. They brag about their partnerships with the AFL-CIO and community organizing dictated by corporate America in 165 cities. In Atlanta last June, I stumbled into a meeting supposedly against mass incarceration, but the AFL-CIO community organizer, who was a longtime staffer at CWA, her card was Janine Brown, Communications Workers of America, but her email address was a United Way address, and her card was a United Way address. But anyway, what they're doing is they were building for a series of public meetings where people would come up and testify in public about their awful experience with the prison system. But what they were pushing in the legislature was what they called a no conviction, no restriction bill, which meant that they would erase your encounter with the police if it didn't result in a conviction. And that's all they could do for us, okay? That's all they could do for us. That's, on the other hand, we've got organizations like a big national civil rights organization, which I guess I'm not going to name. I was debating myself whether I'd name them. They were involved in the response to the Georgia prison strike in December 2010, when a bunch of prisoners in a dozen prisons in Georgia stood up. And what this national organization did after we begun to got some traction is their national leader, after we got two observer teams into prisons, citizens observer teams into prisons, unrestricted, their national leader flew in one night unannounced, met with Governor Deal, and flew back out. And then they withdrew from the coalition. But it turns out that they have organic ties with all the black Democrats in our state, and that now what's going to happen is these black Democrats in this organization are going to push the Republican governor's agenda for correctional justice reform. It includes drug courts. They're going to actually, they say they're going to let out 8,000 to 10,000 prisoners, but they're going to try to put them under restrictive regimes on the street. And they might even, and this is the key victory, they might even end shackling of juveniles and maybe of pregnant women when they're giving birth in custody. Maybe. That has, the juvenile thing is a done deal. The pregnant women thing, they're still working on that. And that will be the legislative victory that the movement against mass incarceration, when it's bounded by corporate organizers and corporate philanthropy and Democrats will give us. We've got to create our own space. I only get a few minutes here, so I invite you to go to www.endmassincarceration.com, where we've got 13 demands that came from some meetings of families of ex-offenders in Georgia. The other big challenge to creating a movement against mass incarceration, your movement against mass incarceration has to be rooted among the families of the incarcerated. It has to be led in large part by the formerly incarcerated themselves. If you can't manage that, you can't do this. And it has to have ties with the families and individuals and groups of prisoners who are still behind the walls. What we do is we're standing outside of courthouses and just grabbing the people as they come out of court and talking to them. And that's how we're beginning to establish relations with a large number of inmate families. With that, I thank you for coming here, and thank you for your interest in rolling back the prison state. And this is something that Democrats aren't really going to be much help for us. They'll get, I mean, not shackling pregnant women is a good thing. Okay? That's a good thing. And that's a victory. But we got to roll back a prison state. We've got to put those 1 million bailiffs and contractors out of work. That's where it is. Thank you.
Bruce Dixon of Black Agenda Report, preceded by Barr's Nellie Bailey, me, Glenn Ford, and Margaret Kimberly. The Stop Mass Incarceration Network has designated April 19th as a national day of resistance to the many evils of the U.S. criminal justice system. Carl Dix is part of the network and an initiator of the Stop and Frisk campaign. Carl Dix compares the vigilante killing of Trayvon Martin to the infamous 1857 Supreme Court Dred Scott decision.
Well, I think there's a very direct relation because, as you know, in the Dred Scott decision, the U.S. Supreme Court put in its decision to return an escaped African to slavery that black men have no rights that white men are bound to respect. And I think when you look at the Trayvon Martin murder, you're seeing an underscoring that though they will no longer write that into the proceedings, in actual fact, that is the situation that we're dealing with. I mean, Trayvon Martin went out to a store to get some iced tea and Skittles, and he's coming back, talking on the phone to a friend, wearing a hoodie and his black skin. That was enough to get him targeted as up to no good, suspicious, probably on drugs, by George Zimmerman, a cop wannabe who headed up a neighborhood watch group. He phones in his suspicions. He trails Trayvon. Against the advice of the police, he goes out to confront him and blows him away. And then he claims self-defense, and the police in this small southern town decide that that claim of self-defense is all they need to let this vigilante murderer go free. Now, I say, though, that this applies across the board because the police in big towns, you know, like New York City, like Chicago, like San Francisco, like L.A., do the same doggone thing all the time. I mean, we could talk about Ramarley Graham up in the Bronx. We could talk about the sister Rebecca Boyd in Chicago, where police fired into a park crowded with people, killed her. You know, we could talk about an unending number of cases, and we could talk about how in almost every one of those cases, the murderers of the black people, mostly black men, but also black women as well, get away scot-free. So the society is still telling us that our humanity, our right to life, and everything else is not something that this white supremacist society has to respect. And I think that's something that we have to understand and act on. And people are acting in response to the Trayvon murder, but we need to broaden the scope of things and see all of the abuse, the brutality, the miserization and the murder that's being brought down on black people in this country and on people all around the world by this United States imperialist capitalist society, and stand up against it, resist it, and work to build a movement to get rid of it through revolution.
Vigilante murder, police murder, mass incarceration, it's all part of a whole pattern of devaluation of black life. And on April 19th, you're going to have a day of resistance.
Yes, and see, this is very important because it's very, very good that people have seen the Trayvon Martin murder for the injustice that it is and are standing up around it. But like I said earlier, we have to, spread the lens out and see that the injustice of the Trayvon Martin murder is not an isolated incident, but it is just the latest in a seemingly never-ending chain of abuse that the society is bringing down on black and brown people, and we need to stand up in that way. That's why we call for this day of National Day of Resistance to mass incarceration, to the racial profiling that leads to the 2.4 million people who are warehoused in prison, to the second-class citizenship that people are held in even after they serve their sentences. All of this is unjust. All of it needs to be resisted. And we're calling for a leap in the resistance to that, because there's already been a lot of very good exposure by Michelle Alexander and others of this, but there needs to be commensurate resistance, and we want to make that kind of leap. So on that day, we're calling on people all across the country to take this up, to get involved. Go from your anger around the injustice of the murder of Trayvon Martin to anger around all of the abuse that the criminal injustice system in this country is bringing down on black and brown people. So here in New York, we're going to be targeting the police. We're going down to One Police Plaza. Information is coming in from Los Angeles, from the San Francisco, Oakland area, from other parts of the country, and everybody within the sound of my voice needs to hear about that and get involved. Take this up, be a part of it. We're beginning a campaign to begin the trend Stop Mass Incarceration on Twitter under the hashtag of SMIA19 to push that out and get a lot of the people who've been moved by the Trayvon murder to see that it is, like I said, just the tip of an iceberg.
Carl Dix of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network in New York. The Trayvon Martin killing has created a firestorm of indignation in black America, the likes of which has not been seen since the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. It seems that every black organization in every city, large and small, has responded to the outrage. In Minneapolis, 5,500 people gathered to mourn and demand justice for Trayvon. Sam Mendeli, a senior at the University of Minnesota, was one of the organizers. He says students were appalled at the circumstances of Trayvon's death.
Yes, it was a great shock. Unfortunately, we see deaths like this occur due to gun violence on a daily basis. But the fact for me personally, and the fact that I've shared with a lot of my friends and peers, is that with us knowing who the murderer was and the police being there on the scene, and for him not to even be arrested and, charged with any kind of murder or incident because of the Stand Your Ground law and the fact that he can claim self-defense in that situation, it's appalling to me. I feel like if it was another situation, like, you would have the person who committed the murder would have been arrested and, charged and would be in jail until, he was able to come out on bail and whatnot and do all that. But he didn't even spend any time in jail. He was let free that same night, wasn't tested for any drugs or alcohol or anything of that nature. So, and just as the information continues to unfold, it's just more and more disheartening of the way in the justice system is down there in Sanford and how flawed, the overall system is. We're just happy that we can show our solidarity to Trayvon Martin and his family and to the thousands of other Trayvon Martins that have been lost their lives due to gun violence or injustices, racial profiling, whatever it may be. Because he's not the first and he won't be the last, unfortunately. But as long as we can come together on issues like this to show that we're not going to stand for it, I feel that we're going in the right direction.
Student leader Sam Endeli in Minneapolis. In the nation's capital, a national Occupy Washington campaign has begun, complete with its own newspaper, the Occupied Washington Post. Kevin Zeese is one of the organizers. He hopes the Occupy Washington campaign will lift the Occupy movement to a new level of activity. We ask Zeese if this is the second phase of the movement that the people have been anticipating.
We hope it's the second phase. We see it as, in our view, it's a chance to get occupiers together to really share experiences, discuss things, and figure out next steps. And that's what we want to do. This is, in our view, the American Spring, at least in Washington, D.C. We see, of course, actions all over the country still going on. But we see this as a chance for occupiers really to reflect a little bit and think back as well as think forward and really come to a much higher level of activity and much more focused with a clear demand of shifting power away from the concentrated wealth to the people.
Well, you have had time to reflect. So where is this movement going and how far has it taken us?
You know, I think it came a lot further than we expected when we started planning the occupation at Freedom Plaza almost a year ago, by the way, in April of last year. When we started planning that, we didn't know how big it would get and how far it would advance the cause. And I think it advanced the cause further than we expected. It got more people involved around the country thanks to Occupy Wall Street and their incredible leadership up there, and thanks to the New York City Police, who showed the abusive power of the state that enraged people and got people more active. So I think it had a big effect. More than 100 people's homes have been saved and families kept from foreclosure. We stopped the super committee from decimating Social Security and Medicare. They were on the path to do that before Occupy started to protest. We stopped the president and Department of Justice from giving immunity to the banks. They were on the road to doing that as well, immunity from criminal prosecution as well as civil suits by homeowners. So I think we've had a pretty big impact in the first 6 months, but we've also made mistakes, and I think we have to learn from those mistakes and be very clear about what our intentions are. And we've also got to start to deal with the reality that we're beginning to scare the powers. We're seeing infiltration, we're seeing disruption, and we have to figure out strategies to deal with those issues as well.
Well, in the interim, we've also had passage of a preventive detention bill that should scare us.
It does, yes. So I think those are, in fact, I think both that preventive, the NDAA, as well as the act that allows for prosecution on federal properties if there's somebody under Secret Service protection, I think those are both designed in reaction to Occupy, and probably in reaction to Tea Party as well, at least the early phase of the Tea Party, when they were really protesting the system with a lot of anger. So I do think that those are signs of the elite becoming afraid and starting to put in place the powers they need to control the people. And I think the only response we can have is to get more active and to show that we're not going to be intimidated by that kind of excessive abuse of their power. So that's going to take some courage on our part, but it's going to be essential to be successful.
And also, thanks to a vigilante in Florida and his collaborators in a Florida small-town police department, we also have the Justice for Trayvon movement.
No question. That's an issue we focus on in the Occupied Washington Post. And I think it's, again, there was an event on Long Island this weekend where an African-American was shot in his home, after calling for emergency help. So this is a long-term problem of police abuse, allowing either vigilante justice or police doing it themselves. And so I think it's great these are coming to light and people getting organized and angry about it. Now we got to make sure we take that anger and turn it into a really mobilized and focused effort. That's what the Occupy needs to become.
And is there a danger that the Occupy in this second phase will get lost in the presidential election?
Well, we're doing our best to stop that. I think it's pretty clear from most occupiers that they want to be independent of the two parties. They recognize the electoral system is a mirage. It's a flawed system, a corrupted system. It's elections of money that dominate not the voters, the votes of the people. We get manipulated into voting against our interests by having two corporate candidates, whether it's Romney or Obama. They're both getting lots of money from the health insurance industry since they both forced Americans to buy health insurance. They're getting a lot of money from Wall Street. They are definitely special interest candidates, approved by the corporate powers. So they're not going to do the kind of change we want. And so I think more occupiers, I think, really see that. There's been constant efforts by, Democratic operatives to try to, take over the Occupy movement and move us into the Democratic Party. But that would be the death knell for the Occupy movement. I think a lot of occupiers get that.
And that's it for this week's Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.